This will be a fascinating night for you. Paul Hellyer with us. He's the former Canadian Minister of Defense. His latest work is called The Money Mafia, A World in Crisis. We're going to get with Paul to talk with him about that this hour. We're going to talk with him about his other work, Light at the End of the Tunnel, a little bit later on. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Paul Hellyer with us, Canada's youngest member of parliament when he was first elected back in 1949, and the youngest cabinet minister appointed to Louis S. St. Laurent's government 8 years later. Now, although Paul is best known for the unification of the Canadian Armed Forces and for his 1968 chairmanship of the Task Force on Housing and Urban Development there, he has maintained a lifelong interest in macroeconomics, leading him to form the Action Canada Group, a populist movement dedicated to the concepts of full employment, low inflation, emphasis on quality of life issues. I'm all for that, too. He's written several works, Light at the End of the Tunnel, which we talked with him about several years ago, and The Money Mafia, A World in Crisis. Welcome back to Coast, Paul Hellyer. Paul, it's always a pleasure. How are you, sir?
I'm well, thank you, George. How about yourself?
Good, good. I remember you and I, we sat down at a roundtable dinner in Washington, D.C., Edgar Mitchell, the astronaut, next to us.
That was about six years ago, I think. Sure was.
Gosh, time flies, doesn't it?
Doesn't it ever, yeah.
Paul, for a lot of people, because I think this is critical to tonight's discussion with you about the money mafia. For a lot of people who are joining our program, they might not know who you are. Explain to us, if you would, your credentials, because that, to me, sets the stage for everything we're going to talk about.
Well, I think, George, the most important thing is that I've spent most of my life in either politics or business, and I went through the ranks in politics, as you suggested. I was elected at a very early age and went through the ranks quickly and became Minister of the Crown, as we call them up here. You call them secretaries.
Mm-hmm.
And so my most important portfolio was Minister of National Defense, which I held for a number of years. And then after that, I was Minister of Transport and also responsible for housing in Canada from the federal point of view. And then after I got out of the government, I resigned on a point of principle related to housing because the government was dragging its feet and I didn't like what they were doing because they weren't doing what they should have been doing, which is, I think, typical of governments. And so since then, I have been engaged in various things. I was a reporter, a newspaper columnist for a number of years. I wrote my memoirs a number of years ago. This book, the new one, The Money Mafia, is my 14th book.
Good for you. Good for you. And they're all riveting, Paul.
Well, they all have something to say, George. One thing they have in common, excuse me, they start out talking about the problems in the world, but I've never written a book yet where I didn't propose solutions. And I don't really think it's fair for people to say, well, the world's going to hell in a handbasket, which in my opinion it is. And then say, but we can't do anything about it or don't know what to do about it, because I don't think that really helps. But I think it helps if you have solutions, however difficult they might be to put into effect. And that has been a trademark of all of my books to date, and certainly The Money Mafia, World in Crisis is no exception. It is probably, well, it is by far the most important book I've ever written. And it goes into what is wrong in the world to a greater extent than I have ever done before. And then on the solution side, it goes more deeply into quite a lot of practical things that have to be done if we're going to change things the way that everybody would like to see them changed, but nobody does anything about it.
Now, you're, of course, you're in Canada. Your career's been in Canada. Does Canada somewhat echo the United States in terms, in shadow it, in terms of events that occur? If we have a downturn in the economy in the United States, Paul, will Canada have that too?
Normally it will, yes. It'll follow fairly closely. There have been a few cases where we have managed to stay away from your pattern a little bit. We did in the recent meltdown, 2008-09, for example. Our banks fared better than yours, and we had a more stable system up here, and things didn't go quite as wrong for us. But normally, if you get a disease of some kind down there, it creeps across the border, and we have the same sort of thing up here, and just have to kind of put up with it.
Well, not only tonight are you being heard in the United States, but we've got a huge Canadian following. We're in every major city in Canada too, Paul. So
I understand.
A lot of people are going to get this message. The Money Mafia. Tell me about the headline, about the title.
Well, the title is really related to the fact that an international banking cartel has been ripping off the people of the world for, a long time, but in particular the last 300 years. And they have managed to put into effect a system of money creation which doesn't make any sense whatsoever, and which is a ripoff. And that's the reason that I call the book Money Mafia.
They've got the greatest game going, don't they?
They have the greatest game going, and it's a game that has been so incredibly profitable for them, but incredibly bad for everybody else, because they create all the money as debt, or nearly all of it, and they get the gravy, and we get the debt. So I don't know how extent. I'd like to go into this subject of some length, if I may.
Well, you're on with me for 3 hours tonight, Mr. Hellyer, so we've got a long way.
We've got a lot to talk about.
That's right.
Well, it's most people don't understand money and where it comes from, and they have some mystic view of it, you know, and they kind of think, I don't know what it is, but I know I haven't got enough of it. And in olden days, way back, of course, most money used to be coins,
mm-hmm.
and that was the most important thing. And then later on, of course, the economies got so large that we had to switch to paper money. And today, of course, nearly all of our money is electronic. It's just a computer entry. And so you have these millions and millions of people really around the world that have no jobs and no future for lack of a few well-placed computer entries. So if you want to go back, you go back, say, to the time that or just a little before the Bank of England was established over 300 years ago. King William was short of money because he'd been engaged in this incredible war with France and was in problems. He didn't have enough money to replace his armaments. He tried to borrow some and couldn't. So some people said, well, we'll lend you the money at 8% if you establish a Bank of England, and in effect will at the same time let us create money, let us lend the same amount of money to our friends, so that they were doing what they were doing was lending the same money twice. Once to the government at 8%, which is a pretty high rate, and with a few extra charges thrown in.
And it was probably money that didn't even exist anyway.
Well, the money they lent the government was at that time. It was gold and silver coins.
That was hard currency then. Okay.
Yeah. And then they printed the money that the government allowed them to lend to their friends, banknotes. And so, in effect, they were lending the same money twice. Well, then that was such a good thing that over the years, the leverage, as we call it, that was a leverage of a 2-to-1, lending the same money twice. Well, over the years, that leverage has increased dramatically. And in the early years of the 20th century in the United States, for example, the federally incorporated banks had to have a gold reserve of 25%, which meant they were banks were allowed to lend four times the money. And then when I was a youngster here in Canada, our banks had to have a cash reserve of 8% so they could lend the same money 12 and a half times.
That's right.
Well, then they kept getting more and more greedy as the years went on, and we got Milton Friedman giving us some abstract ideas from the classroom that didn't make any sense. And we got up to the point where they were lending the same money 20 times.
Jeez.
So what the money mafia is really saying, the other mafia, and we have them here as you have in the United States, and we've had them in the papers a lot the last two or three years because of an inquiry in Montreal where it's alleged that the mafia, or mafia, however you want to say it, has been skimming 2.5% off the top of every construction contract.
Huh.
So, and that's been good work for them, but not so good for the taxpayers of Montreal, and especially there are allegations that sometimes that maybe the work was fairly shoddy as well. So, 2.5% is...
It adds up.
It adds up. Okay. The money system takes 95% off the top. So that's the reason for the title of the book.
How come we're not in that business, Paul?
Well, I don't know. It's because it's sort of a tight little family affair. And
Let me ask you this. Is what they're doing, is it immoral? Is it illegal? How would you categorize it?
Well, it's immoral. They've managed to make it legal. That's where the rub comes in.
Yeah.
They have had politicians, they've done them favors and helped finance wars for them and contributed to their election expenses and done all of this sort of thing. And so they've got the politicians to give them charters which allow them to do under the law, which would be a grand larceny. With giant Ponzi schemes, they'd all be in jail if it was not for these charters that the politicians have granted them, which allow them to do something which is...
And this is worldwide they've been allowed to do this, right?
Absolutely. And we're talking big money. We're talking about trillions of dollars here.
Ugh.
And the problem is, I call it what they really lend you. And, you know, it's funny, a lot of people, including some of my banker friends, were of the...
Are you going to have banker friends after tonight?
Well, they don't really love me anyway. But they're not all bad, but the ones who really make the rules are pretty sharp,
yeah.
That's for sure. What they do, they don't really lend you money. They want people to believe that if you go into the bank to borrow some money, to buy a car or something or other, that the money they lend you is the money that I or somebody else deposited last week. And so they're just taking from one person in a deposit and handing it over to somebody else and charging them interest on it. Well, that is not how the system works at all. What they are lending you is not money, for the most part, it's credit. Their credit. That they have created. So what they're allowed to do under these charters is that if they have 5 cents of what I call blood, sweat money.
Real money. Paul Hellyer's money, George Norrie's money. We go into the bank, put in, let's say a dollar.
Yeah.
We put in a dollar.
But one we've earned out in the fields,
yep,
or in the factory or providing medical services or doing something real, you know. And so they can put in 5 cents worth of that, or $5 or whatever, and then they can lend you 20 times that credit. So they take a dollar from you, they invest a dollar, and they lend you 20.
And even if they don't have it,
They don't have it. It's made out of whole cloth,
and
as
then
they say.
another person comes along, Paul, and deposits another, let's say, dollar. They do it. They do it 20 times again, right?
Exactly, more or less. That's the way the system works, or they increase their capital under the present system. If they in this Larcenous system are able to make a profit and to keep a little bit of it, then they can use that earned capital to rivet up another 20 times and lend it back out. And it's a never-ending game. If you look at their assets, they keep going up year after year after year, because what their assets are really just paper.
What do they want, Paul? You know, one could assume they have more money than God. What do they want? Is this a game for them? Do they just seem to enjoy this?
Well, I think partly it's everybody enjoys playing Monopoly. But I think it's money and power. It's greed and power. And
that's their aphrodisiac, isn't it?
Well, I guess. Yeah, I don't know. I've never done it, so I don't want to speculate.
I would assume if you have everything you need monetarily, that greed and power is the exception, and I think that's almost their hunger.
It must be, because it just keeps going on, and the situation gets worse. And of course, they have so much power, and this is something that we can talk about in a few minutes if you're interested.
Sure.
They have so much power that they are the apex of what I call throughout my book the cabal, which is and has been running the United States for the last 50 or 60 years, and which has taken over the reins of government from the legitimate democratic system.
Right. We think we elect presidents.
Right.
All we are doing is playing a game.
That's right. We're playing the game. We vote for one of the candidates that they pick and finance, and then they manage by subtle means to get that person to go along with the plans that they have for the country or for the world.
And if that person doesn't want to go along with the plan,
well, then they have quiet talks, and they're one-term presidents or whatever.
Or they become JFK.
Yeah.
Interesting. And this cabal is, how many people do you think, Paul, are in this?
Well, it's, I don't know, and I don't know that anybody knows, because it's a very loosely knit
secretive
kind of organization.
Is this beyond what we have called the Bilderbergs, and, you know, those elitists and those Illuminati folks? Is this beyond them?
Well, it's now bigger than they're part of it. The banking cartel and the oil cartel and the multinational corporations and certain parts of the U.S. intelligence agencies and certain parts of the U.S. Armed Forces are all in it together now, as far as what we're talking about now. We've just moved into shadow government. Who's really running?
Okay, hold on for a second, Paul. We're going to take this break. We're going to come right back with Paul Hellyer as we talk about the money mafia, a world in crisis. Well, welcome back. Paul Hellyer with us, of course, his work, The Money Mafia. Paul, we were talking about the cabal, and they seem to be getting bigger and bigger and bigger, aren't they?
Yeah, they are, and more powerful, and more to be feared, I think, than they're just in my opinion, pretty well out of control, and they do these things which are not in the, you know, when we were talking about leverage in the money system, mm-hmm. you take a half of the students I know finish school now, finish university with debts of $50,000. And the banks only had to have $2,500 of blood sweat money, what I call blood sweat money.
To lend them?
To lend them, oh. The student, $50,000. And the student has got to pay back $50,000 in blood sweat money, not $2,500.
That's right.
$50,000 plus interest.
Of created money. I mean, so the bank, yeah. The bank's really into it for $2,500, right?
Yeah, and created money. And then, of course, in addition to all this, every once in a while, they decide to crash the system and be able to pick up assets that the biggest banks are cheap and put the small guys out of business. It's just, it is absolutely, totally immoral. Anyway, you mentioned just before the break about parts of the cabal, and
yeah,
three very important parts are what I call the three sisters. And I have a chapter on them.
The three evil sisters. Huh?
You know, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Bilderbergers, and the Trilateral Commission.
Uh-huh.
And of these, the Council on Foreign Relations is the oldest. And even before World War II was over, they were plotting an empire, which was to be bigger than the empire that the German people were planning or hoping for. And it was to be very wide in scope, and they've been working at it ever since. Well, then the Bilderbergers, who started out, you know, with a few decent ideas related to European Union and so on, and so you have to give a little credit for what happened at the beginning. But then they have evolved into the apex of the cabal, and they really have tremendous power and have had and still do, and that's where the bankers are, it's right up there at the top, and they manage to and the Trilateral Commission, which is the newest of the three, you know, was a rather late idea, but when they thought that Japan should be brought into the triangle, mm-hmm. between Europe, the United States, and Japan, when Japan was on its ascendancy. And so it's fairly new. But these three organizations, and it's hard to tell which one is the most powerful, because the Council on Foreign Relations claims that it is. That, well, there's a famous quote there that I have in the book about the Council on Foreign Relations is running the world. And I don't know, some of the Bilderbergers might question that, but on the other hand, there are a lot of the same people. So it's hard to tell. They just change your sweaters, yeah. You know, going from one to the other.
It seems too, Paul, that they've got a foothold on this. I don't see how it's ever going to break loose.
Well, we'll talk about that later, because if it doesn't, why, heaven help us. They have plans for what they call the New World Order.
Yep.
And it is, as you know, a plan to replace the Republic of the United States and democracies with an unelected government answerable to them. And what we're talking about is a dictatorship, a government that, you know, is totally autocratic. You could call it whatever you want to, but it's a government of the same ilk that we have seen upset the world from time to time when it was established. That kind of government was established in either the USSR or the German Republic. And so they have some pretty ambitious plans for us, and I don't think that the people are really aware of what they are or how far advanced that they are, and consequently we have to expose the fact that there's something going on that that we don't like, and that frankly was the reason I wrote this book, because when I did Light at the End of the Tunnel 4 years ago, I really thought that was it. It was my final effort.
I did too. I thought you were going to stop then.
So we were on the same wavelength there, George.
Yeah.
But then, since then, and maybe as a result of that book, people have been giving me information about what is really going on, and it is frightening. And so I decided, well, gee whiz, I've got to write about this, and more than that, I've got to write about some things that the world has got to do, the United States has got to do, and the world has got to do, if there's any possibility whatsoever of preventing them from carrying out what they intend to do. And it's big stuff, and so that was the reason for the book. But, you know, I don't make my living by writing books. On the contrary, if I did, I'd be broke. But I really hope that people who care a damn about the future of the United States or about the world will get a copy of this book and read it, and then and look at the list of suggestions that comes later in the book, and pick the ones that they think are really important, and send them off to their candidate for Congress, and right away, before the midterm elections, start some real debate about what is necessary for the U.S. and the world, rather than just these superficial things that seem to be the what happens all the time.
Paul, look into a crystal ball for a moment, and if this doesn't stop, if it continues to grow the way it's growing, paint us a picture of what the next 10 or 20 years might be.
Well, I don't know that it's even that long. I think the plan is ultimately to impose martial law and establish this authoritarian government, which would be...
But they're going to want people to work, right? They're going to want people to work and buy goods and services.
Well, yeah, but the people have no choice but to do that, because the cabal has all the power and all the money. And so if you want enough even to live on, if you want a roof over your head or enough food, to feed you and your family, you're going to have to do what they say. And you can see the trend that's been going on. They've been driving middle-class wages down. They're paying a pittance.
Oh, yeah. I mean, manufacturing's leaving. I don't know about Canada, but the United States, I don't know what we make anymore.
Well, a lot of people make too little to live on. There is not a living wage. I think the president at one time said that everyone should have a living wage. Well, I agree with that, and I mentioned it in my book. But they don't have it. And one of the things that should be established is a living wage, so that people can breathe and they can live and have a little bit of comfort without being really slaves to debt. Yep.
Are Canadians concerned about this as well? I mean, you are, and you're Canadian, but I mean, are your fellow Canadians concerned about this?
Well, you know, George, I think fellow Canadians are like fellow Americans, that they're so concerned about keeping a roof over their head and food on the table.
Sure.
That they don't have time to think about it or to read books. And unfortunately, they get most of their information from the mainline press, from the television and radio, and from press that is controlled by the cabal. And so they really don't know what's going on, and they just say, well, we have to go to work and earn enough to pay the mortgage, or we're going to be out in the streets, so haven't got time to think about these things, hope things will improve. Mm-hmm. And maybe somebody that's promising something will live up to their promises, but based on the record, it seldom happens.
What would you recommend that people do? How do you stop it?
Well, let's come back to this a little later about the list of things that have to be done.
Can it be done, though?
Pardon me?
Can it be fixed?
Theoretically, yes. But people have to use their power. We had a little bit of it in New York when the people were marching for global warming.
Yep.
Concerned about the future of the planet, and rightly so. And what's happening at government is they're ignoring it. This is the number one problem facing the world today. I've been just reading something about what happened thousands of years ago when there was a climate change occurred, and as a result of the asteroid hitting Earth, and it wiped out the dinosaur species. Species had been declining and so on, and maybe that was... maybe that gave us the opportunity to be here. We're starting a cycle where we're eliminating many species, and we're heating up the planet, as happened then. And it is so serious, that if we don't do something about it right away, we could almost eliminate the human species within some period of time. I don't know how long. But,
we've heard, Paul, that they would love to see the 7 billion people reduced down to 500 million. I'm sure you've heard that, too.
I have heard it. It's on the Internet, and there are a lot of different figures. But they should not be allowed to determine the destiny of the planet and its people. That should be a function of the people themselves. And that is the reason that we have to take some drastic action. Let me talk about one of the things related to global warming. In my book, I propose, well, first of all, I have a long list of headlines related to the oil industry, just one after another. They're going to do more drilling in the Atlantic Ocean. They're going to do more drilling in the Gulf of Mexico. They're going to do more drilling in the Beaufort Sea.
More fracking, more everything.
More extending the tar sands in Alberta with the consequences of that mess there. And more fracking, which is, in my opinion, something we should not do at all. So I list all of these headlines, which reflect what the governments are doing and allowing, and say, hey, isn't there a disconnect here somewhere? The reality is that our house is on fire. And so when that happens, and I had it happen once to me years ago when I was at the upper school, a phone rang, and when I finally found out what it was all about, it was, my place was on fire. I had to get home in a heck of a hurry, and by the time I got there, it was all over. My wife and baby daughter just got out by the skin of their teeth with the flames coming through the glass risers at the side of the store that we had to use to get to the apartment above. And that's where we are today. So somebody has got to yell fire, and we have to respond to it immediately, not 10 years from now or 20 years from now or 50 years from now, but now. And what I've proposed on that score is that we set an immediate goal of 7 years. And light at the end of the tunnel, I said 10. But, you know, 3 or 4 years gone by, so I'm now saying 7. We should set an immediate goal of replacing the fuel system in every car, truck, tractor, airplane, and home, and ship in the next 7 years.
They could do that if they wanted to.
Absolutely. You're dead on. It is possible. And that's where the people come in, because we have to force our leaders to come down to Earth, to start worrying about the Earth and do something instead of saying, oh, well, we're going to reduce emissions a little bit this year and a little bit next year, and we're going to have a fight about that, and we're going to have a fight about who's going to pay for them and all this sort of thing, instead of saying we are going to change from a fossil fuel economy to a clean energy economy in 7 years and save our planet, period. And as you say, it is possible, and I know that because I lived through World War II. I'm a child of the Depression, as you know, and we did it then on the reverse way. Every automobile company and every manufacturing company for refrigerators and stoves and all of these things were all converted from that kind of good to making armaments, to making tanks.
I mean, Paul, you're amazing with your... How old are you right now?
I'm 91.
91 years old?
Yeah.
You've got more endurance than most people in their 50s.
Well, I'm blessed. I'm still mobile, still upright and mobile.
Well, and we're coming up to the top of the hour here, but you brought up something interesting. I mean, you're a product of World War II. During World War II, we seemed to have a purpose. You know, we're out to get the Germans and the Japanese, the Italians who had banded together, that evil empire. And we as a world got together, the Canadians, the United States, the Britons. We had a purpose. And,
right.
And we went and accomplished that.
Right.
I don't feel that anymore. I'm confused.
Well, you're right. We don't feel it, but we have to feel it. And the war that I was just describing, in order to save our planet, our home, is where we can unite. I think it was, one of the generals said that if the visitors from other planets were to come and attack us or cause us some problem, then we would unite against them. But we don't have to worry about them, because the real problem today is us. It's about our leaders and about their refusal to take their responsibilities seriously and to get out and start this business of changing from an economy which depends on war, producing products for war, and convert that to creating those small little boxes of pure energy that are necessary to put in our cars and our trucks and our planes and all of that.
We could also, protect, I've got this national campaign going, Paul, where I want to protect our power grid from an EMP attack or some kind of X flare from the sun. Because, once the power grid goes, we're up the creek.
Well, what I'm talking about does that automatically, because every house has its own power supply.
That's right. You won't worry about the power grid.
You don't have to worry about the power grid. It's gone.
Stay with us. We're going to hit this break. We're going to come back. We've got two more hours to go with Paul Hellyer as we talk about his work, the Money Mafia. I'm going to spend a little more time talking about that. A little later on tonight, we're going to talk about his thoughts of ETs. You've got to hear that, too. And then we'll take some phone calls in our final hour. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.